You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel. Coming up this week in episode 297, the nightly show on ITV. Can it possibly be as bad as the reviews say it is? Boxing. It's brutal, it's dangerous, and it's scary. So why do we watch it? And last week it was Stormzy, this week it's... Ed Sheeran dominating the top 40. Does anyone take any notice of the singles charts anymore? It's all coming up after World Party and Ship of Fools.
Save Me From Tomorrow, from 1987 World Party and Ship of Fools. Welcome to the podcast from the Parish Council. It's episode 297, though in reality it's episode 306, but I figure, you know, we shouldn't really go through all of that again.
Let's not re-rehearse the entire point.
I'm Terence Stackham, and she's all aboard. It's Juliet Harris.
Honk, hello, good evening, or good morning, or good afternoon, depending on where you are in the world.
Yeah, late night, light-hearted chat shows have been a staple of American television for over 60 years. First with Steve Allen, then Johnny Carson, then Jay Leno, David Letterman, through to the current era in 2017 when there's so many of them, it's hard to keep count, especially as all the hosts are called Jimmy or James.
yeah, quite.
Over the years, there's been a handful of well-intentioned attempts at nailing a late-night television talk show in the UK. Johnny Vaughan 15 years ago, Graham Norton on Channel 4 around the same time, neither really worked out. In the UK, we seem to prefer the format to be placed in the earlier part of the evening. Paul O'Grady found success with the tea time viewers, and BBC One's The One Show appears to be thriving.
It's quite often inane, but there seems to be an audience for that sort of thing. It's probably the best thing you could say about The One Show.
I couldn't watch it, but as you say, it's it has its audience. So it was somewhat of a surprise to find ITV shoving the news at 10 aside to make way for yet another attempt at a 5-night-a-week talk show. Now into its second week, The Nightly Show has already had a substantial thumping from the critics in the UK press, and viewers haven't been impressed as the figures have slumped over the days. Jules, you tuned in for a taste of The Nightly Show. Surely it's not as bad as they say.
Well, I mean, to start off with, I was expecting an every evening dose of Keira Knightley, so I was extremely disappointed when actually The Nightly Show didn't have a K at the front. That was we didn't get off to the best of starts for that reason. It was rubbish. It was I said you told me to watch it. You asked me if I would watch it. You asked me if I would be willing to watch it, and I said yes, which is a word that I came to regret fairly quickly, having sat through it. It was just pants, really. It was trying to be. The problem was that anybody that has any familiarity with those American type shows, and particularly, it made me think of Saturday. The thing that annoyed me about it was trying to be all of those American shows at once. So it was trying to do political satire. So it was trying to do The Daily Show over in the States when it was John Oliver. Now it's Trevor Noah. And then it was also trying to do Saturday Night Live with all the sketches and. The problem, and it also made me think, the problem was that we seemed to lack the stars over here to kind of carry that off. Had it been someone like Graham Norton, who I think is a superb radio live broadcaster and a really superb broadcaster in terms of doing live television, live presenting like that, he probably could have made it work. Maybe somebody like David Mitchell, who would have the wit to kind of make it work, would. But unfortunately, and I don't mean this to be as disrespectful as it sounds to the people that have been hosting it, it looks like they're going on a different host every week, which is difficult then to establish regularity. I can see what they're doing, but you know, it doesn't give anybody ever a chance to settle, because by the time they've settled 3 or 4 days in, they're then done and it's the next person. But if you're going to try and have big star or someone to anchor this, can it be someone a little bit less jaded and end of the pier than John Bishop and David Walliams? I mean, I don't dislike John Bishop, but the whole thing just smacked of a bit. It was trying to be zippy and American, and it was just kind of end of the pier nonsense, really. I wasn't that keen on it, really. I wanted it to be good. But, you know, when they brought dogs out as guests on one of the ones recently that I watched, because I have watched it more than once, I don't know why, I didn't necessarily feel like it was zinging, so to speak. Interestingly as well, I'm not a male reader, as regular listeners or anyone that's ever been in a room with me can probably guess. But I did note when looking up about this to see how it was doing generally, because I was thinking, well, this is rubbish, but then what do I know? Maybe, you know, like The One Show, there are a nation full of people I think this is great. Mel and Sue were meant to be in the frame to be hosting it, apparently, of Bake Off fame, and they of course have form hosting daily shows.
Yes,
they made their sort of name on telly doing something called Light Lunch, for people that aren't familiar with this, back in the 90s, which I used to quite enjoy, actually. I had a week of flu off school once and actually felt I knew them personally by the end of the week, because I watched it every day, and they were great. They then did something called Late Lunch, in the evening on Channel 4, which wasn't quite as successful, but it was still all right. They were parachuted into Rise, Channel 4's ill-fated breakfast show, to steady the ship, and managed to for a bit. And they are, I think, fairly good quality live presenters, and I think they could perhaps find a way through with it. They have apparently, to quote the Mail, got cold feet over struggling ratings and won't go anywhere near it.
Really?
Now, apparently, won't sign on the line. It's alleged, apparently. They were, a source tells The Sun, so then we've got the Mail quoting The Sun here, so obviously, you know, ideal reporting as far as I'm concerned, but it says it looked as though it was all but finalised, but they never quite signed on the dotted line. Unfortunately, the talk collapsed when they decided they couldn't possibly make their diaries fit with ITV and have had to turn down the offer. That suggests to me that this ain't going to run, is it really? And apparently, again, like I say, when you look at the people that are up next that have been put in to try and get it back on its feet again, Dermot O'Leary and Davina McCall are next in the hot seat to try and get the stalled series back in favour. I just can't see it happening. An excellent tweet has said, hashtag nightly show. I tried. I really tried. I wanted John Bishop to smash it. All it's done is make me want to smash my TV. So, I mean, I did feel for John Bishop a little bit because he was obviously struggling. But, I mean, it doesn't know what it wants to be, and it's not very good as a result, really, I think, was my view of the nightly show.
I found the whole thing very peculiar. I watched the edition from Wednesday, the 8th of March. That's last night for us as we record this. And a very strange opening with John Bishop reading, I thought, very awkwardly from the auto cue.
Yes.
Perhaps through nerves, but it seems unlikely. But
kind of understand.
Yeah, he was yelling, even though he was mic'd up and in a small theatre. And then we went into a segment where Bishop impersonated Kylie. I don't know if you saw that bit, but it might have been lightly amusing if they'd held it.
I saw him impersonate Madonna one night this week.
Oh, okay. Well, he did Kylie last night. And if they'd kept it to about 10 seconds, it might have been sort of just mildly. But the clip went on forever. And then, as you say, now this was one of the issues for me, the traditional topical jokes routine, which, you know, through the generations, Johnny Carson, Letterman.
Yeah.
But it was delivered sitting down, rather like Andrew Neil on This Week.
Which is bad enough as it is sometimes.
Well, it doesn't work. I think there's a reason why comedians deliver jokes standing up, or in Michael McIntyre's case, pacing around.
Gamping about, yes.
And being this desk-bound routine showed why, and, you know, it just seemed terribly static, and obvious targets, Trump, Corbyn, Philip Hammond, and then unbelievably, considering, you know, they're supposed to have teams of writers for this, the kind of big gag was a 10-year-old out-of-date joke about poking on Facebook. You know, does it?
Oh,
it,
for goodness sake.
That probably wouldn't have been funny in 2008, you know? It was a peculiar thing. And another strange thing that I found about it, just before the break last night, there was a silly quiz with a couple of young millennials. But again, strange.
Oh, see, those crazy millennial folks, of whom I'm almost a member, but not quite.
Very nearly. But the thing was, we suddenly had these two young people, a 19 and an 18-year-old, answering questions. But we weren't told who they were. How were they chosen? If we'd have seen some sort of funny thing that they'd gone out into the street and picked people out of a queue in McDonald's or something, that might have, you know, been an amusing thing. Again, this sort of thing that Letterman used to do. But suddenly in the studio, here were these two young people. Didn't know it was weird. After the break, a section dedicated, it seems to be the interviewing section, interviewing Faye Ripley. Very awkward again, including a tasteless question about stalking, which is
a
funny subject at all. I have a friend who works in that area, and she would, you know, be very clear that there's no human in that. And then finally, I don't know if you saw this, but it was absolutely bizarre. So
I think I gave up after about 10 minutes, I think, so I don't think I did see this.
Okay, really strange thing. A Top Gear style lap of the studio in a little kind of tandem
bug
bike. Buggy thing, yeah. And it seemed to be entirely there so that they could have a pun on the phrase celebrity circuit. You know, let's do a circuit. So it was grim. I sat there thinking, now, could it be rescued? Maybe it could, but this sounds silly, but you really would need a whole new team of writers. I think the point you made, a permanent host.
Absolutely.
And more imaginative guest booking, which again, a point you raised, is that those imaginative guests simply aren't available
There was this quote here. It says, the Mail on Sunday learned that the problems began with the very first show when a Hollywood A-lister Russell Crowe pulled out. And Doc Martin, actor Martin Clunes, was promoted to the star guest slot. A source close to the show said, it was a massive disappointment. Who starts a series like this with Martin Clunes? He is hardly A-list. Which is pretty mean towards Martin Clunes, but it's not inaccurate, I don't think. Apparently, according to this article... we are a family podcast, so I won't announce it fully. But apparently, it's been nicknamed the Nightly Show. If you swap the shirt and the nut around, that's what it's been nicknamed. Apparently, by frustrated ITV executives, it says it has lost half of its 2.2 million viewers since its debut last Monday night.
That's enormous, isn't it? This pilot for it is supposed to run to 8 weeks, and it'll be fascinating to see if it gets
It won't get
far.
There, will it? Someone else says on Twitter, final thoughts, and I would like this too. Someone says, looking forward to Harold Wilson's week as host of The Nightly Show.
God, yeah. That's
even a dug up Harold Wilson would be better than some of the candidates on offer.
Do you know what that's a reference to? He hosted a... I'm afraid it was later in his life, and I'm sad to say already his dementia was kicking in, and Channel 4 had this late night show where they had the most unlikely hosts, and it was an open-ended talk show. You had about 8 people sitting around a table, and it started, 11 at night, and then it was completely open-ended. It didn't finish till it finished.
It's called Friday Night, Saturday Morning.
That would have been it. And it was... Well, I have to say, and this is pushing the boat out, it was worse than The Nightly Show.
And it was BBC Two, apparently.
Oh, BBC Two, right.
So between the two of us, we've got this completely wrong, but I do see what you mean. Yeah, so even worse than The Nightly Show might sort of be an insult to be reckoned with. It's right up there with any Radio 4 listener. The worst insult you can make about a programme is it's even worse than you and yours.
So we don't hold out much hope for ITV's The Nightly Show. Boxing, it's scary, it's brutal. Why do we watch it? That's next after Sly and the Family Stone.
Sometimes I'm right, and I can be wrong. My own beliefs are in my song. The butcher, the banker, the drummer, and then makes no difference what group I'm in. I am everyday people. Yeah.
There is a blue one who can accept the green one for living.
say, I do like a little wiggle around my flat to this. I must admit, it's a great tune. I first heard it, actually. It took me years to hear the original. I heard the Arrested Development version.
Oh, yes.
Which is still very good, I think. I danced to it at a disco. You see, those were the days, and thought it was excellent. And then a couple of months later, someone said, oh, it's based on this original tune by Sly and the Family Stone. And, of course, as everyone knows, I'm a bit of a Northern Soul kind of fan. Loads of people had a go at it. I've enjoyed reading the list of people that have had a go at covering it. Jeff Buckley, Aretha Franklin, and Joan Jett and the Blackhearts as well, apparently. But yeah, that's the original Sly and the Family Stone 1968 tune. It was their first single to go to number one on the Soul Singles Chart and the US Billboard Hot 100, and it's Everyday People.
I still resent Arrested Development. I saw them live.
this is a heck of an opening sentence, isn't it? I still resent Arrested Development, the Terrence Stafford story.
About 25 years ago, it's in Milwaukee, Summerfest, part of the festival circuit in America, and they were due to appear. I thought, oh, great, I'm going to go drive into Milwaukee and go and see Arrested Development, because they were really hot at the time, liked Everyday People and Mr. Wendell, their other hits.
They've got some great tunes. I listened to a best of theirs the other day, and it was really good.
Oh, they were great. And I think they were due on at 9, something like that. It got to midnight and the announcements were still coming out as more and more people left in this lovely middle of summer, open it right by the Lake Michigan in Milwaukee. It was a lovely setting. But me and, of course, my then girlfriend.
Terrence.
I know, there we go again.
The loss is hers.
And I think they finally arrived. So there's something about delays, I think, airline delays or something.
Delays on the M25,
exactly, yeah. But a whole different ball game in Wisconsin. But anyway, I think it was about 1 o'clock in the morning when they came on. We did stick it out, and I tried to enjoy the set. Yeah, I was younger then. But, you know, I think it finished at about 3:30 in the morning in Milwaukee, so I still resent them for that somewhat. I tell you what, though, Sly and the Family Stone, one of the great performances at the Woodstock Festival in 1969.
Oh, yes, of course.
On stage time, 3:30 a.m., which wouldn't appeal to me now, but I suppose.
Well, no, quite.
If you're 20 years old.
Absolutely. Maybe it's something about this song. Maybe it just infuses people with the spirit of lateness.
That's right. Well, going back further, I was saying that was 25 years ago, I saw Arrested Development. But further back than that, in the mid-1970s, I remember having lunch with the sports journalist, Steve Curry, who I think he was with the Daily Express at the time. He'd just come back from covering a big boxing match. It was the Rumble in the Jungle with George Foreman and Muhammad Ali. And the fight was in...
He was Muhammad Ali by that point.
He was, yes.
Cassius Clay.
No, he'd become Muhammad Ali by that point. And the fight was in midweek, oddly enough. Most unlikely these days, but I think it was on a Tuesday night through Wednesday morning, but very peculiar. So I had lunch with Steve Curry a few days later before... We watched Chelsea stumble to a 0-0 draw against Leicester in a season where we were relegated on the last day of the season. That's just background. Here's the thing. I've never forgotten something that Steve Curry said to me.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, it's just a little bit of extra information there. I remember asking when he came back what his major memory was of the fight. And he told me that I've never forgotten this. TV or radio can never portray the full brutality of the punches thrown by boxers, and in particular heavyweight fighters. Mm-hmm. And he said that each and every punch thrown, and I've never forgotten this, as I say, reminded him of the sound of a front door of a house being slammed shut in anger, every punch. And so with that sort of impact, it's little wonder that so many boxers suffer catastrophic injuries or endure, you know, very challenging issues later in life. Now, like me, you watch boxing, Jules. It's brutal, it's barbaric, it's violent. Why do we watch boxing?
Yeah, these are all good points, aren't they? I mean, I remember reading a review somewhere once, and I think it was When We Were Kings, one of the Muhammad Ali films.
That is the film about Rumble in the Jungle.
Yes, yeah. that yeah. very film. Mm. And I remember them someone saying in a review, all this sort of mythologizing of Muhammad Ali, and you know, he was a great man in many ways, but it's very easy to overlook the fact that he used to hit people for a living. And yeah, I mean, like you, I'm not necessarily a regular consumer of boxing. Mm. I don't have Sky, so that kind of limits my watching TV boxing options, unless I choose to go and watch it somewhere else. Sure. So there was this fight, the Haymaker versus Tony Bellew on Saturday night was the big fight. I could talk in very deep detail, and I'm not sure any of us want to hear it, about my psyche and masculinity and the relationship between that and sexuality, and why I go out in a Fred Perry polo shirt and have three beers and then all of a sudden become very interested in boxing. I don't know, there's going to be some deep psychological thing going on there. I used to enjoy watching the Olympic boxing when they used to score it on the screen, so you'd have the red one and the blue one, and sorry, this is very technical, and they'd be welting each other, and you'd have the judges and the things would come up on the screen, so if one did a really good whack on the other, then you know, they get a point or two or whatever. And it was quite interesting to watch the progress of the match and kind of watching it. So obviously it was not a revelation when someone's fist was held in the air at the end, but it was quite interesting watching the psychology behind it, in the same way that I quite like the judges' houses rounds of the X Factor type programs, because you're working out, you're looking into the judges' psyche and working out why they make the decisions that they do. So that aspect of boxing I used to really enjoy. They don't do it anymore. Boxing and judges went horribly wrong at the last Olympics anyway, didn't it? They sacked them all or something because Ireland got cross. I don't know. I was kind of semi-following it. But anyway, so I don't know why I like boxing. It's not, I mean, the problem is that, you know, we know... I think if you're going to watch boxing, if you're going to be involved in boxing, I'm not sure to what extent you can really get upset when someone gets really hurt. Mm. My dad always gets very cross about people that go to watch air shows at places like Biggin Hill and then leave flowers to people that have died in crashes. And his view is that there is a certain ghoulish element of people that go that quite want to see that, really. And whilst my dad is an unrepentant cynic, I think that annoyingly he is right much of the time. And I think that I don't know, I'm just trying to think other parallels. I used to really enjoy watching horse racing, particularly the Grand National. I used to really, really enjoy it. I come from a rich horse racing background. I say rich as in interesting rather than rich as in money. That wasn't really a thing at all. But my dad and granddad were really into racing, and I think they went to Ascot to the Silver Circle once. I mean, they were really into it. And I used to watch the National sort of avidly, and there was a sort of heavy one a few years ago, I think 3 or 4 years ago, when two or three horses died, I think. And I remember watching it thinking, I can't watch this again, because I feel like I'm slightly, you know, conspiring in this, if, you know, I want to watch this and then a horse is dying. Of course, you know, I'm not criticizing the horse racing industry, you know, I think that there are horse, you know, there are horse, where the welfare of racehorses is probably better than any other horses in the world, I should think. But So that made me think about boxing, really, and thinking, yeah, I do quite enjoy watching boxing, but equally, when terrible things happen, like Nick Blackwell was the most recent, and Chris Eubank Jr. and all that sort of thing, part of me thinks, well, yes, the problem is that these things happen because people like me either pay for pay-per-view or go to the pub to watch it, really. So I'm not sure why I like boxing, really, and I kind of wish I didn't, really.
I think, you know, your Popper's point about air shows and people to go to see them, I think is really crucial here, because I think there's possibly some subconscious wish within people to see brutality or even death. And I think there's that takes us to, you know, a sort of link with bullfighting as well, you know. And
it's curious, isn't it? Because both of us are decent people,
yes,
I think. Neither of us would get involved in this sort of thing at all, really.
Not at all. Last weekend's heavyweight fight that you mentioned between David Haye and Tony Bellew, it did hit a new low for me in the pre-bout shenanigans when David Haye made some appalling comments about what he intended to do with Bellew, which of course he failed to do. So I know they do this to try and promote the fight, and it's a style of promotion.
We saw some trash talking. Conversations of trash talking before Christmas, when I went to visit my friend in Nottingham, and me and the husband watched the trash talk. We watched the trash talk on YouTube, and it mostly seemed to be consisting of David Haye making threats of violence and Tony Bellew repeatedly calling David Haye Sideshow Bob because of his hair. That was the intellectual extent of that pre-match bout.
I often say if boxing was banned tomorrow, I wouldn't shed any tears at all, but while it continues, there is just something, especially with the heavyweights and the front door slamming ferocity of the punches. Mm-hmm. It just draws us all into watching it. It's hard to look away.
And it is something that I am slightly ashamed of, I think. So.
Yeah, I kind of am
Although,
as well.
Having said that, my mum watches boxing. Mm. I did not know this until very recently, but she won't watch heavyweights. So when Amir Khan was still sort of boxing regularly, we used to watch him quite a lot. And I think he is a great boxer, but and I think we had a bit of a Prince Nassim thing when I was much younger as well. But like you say, it is one of those things that is really, if you boil it down, it's a horrible thing, but it's kind of easy to get drawn into all the razzmatazz, really. But yes, like you say, I was thinking about this earlier in the week, and even down to the ring girls, so much about this is not me at all. So much about this should offend my feminist urbane sensibilities, and yet there I am. Watching, or catching up with the fact that that a chap has beaten another one on one leg.
Yeah, exactly.
Essentially, yeah. I mean, it was a bit of a shock. I think we'd all expected Tony Bellew to go down pretty quickly, but election data, my favourite election data Twitter account that tweets about by-election polls and whatnot, predicted Tony Bellew predicted David Hay in 3. So if election data gets it wrong, what hope is there for the world?
Absolutely. Every Friday in the UK, a new chart of the most popular songs is published. Do you tune in to find out what's number one on the new top 40?
Well, it's on Fridays now, isn't it?
It's on Fridays.
It's always Fridays, and it's like 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So, you know, some of us are working Radio 1.
That's next, after this delicious new single from Eliza Carthy and the Wayward Band. My favourite musicians of all time, here with the Wayward Band and guest vocals from Teddy Thompson, that's Eliza Carthy, and Hug You Like a Mountain.
I very much enjoyed it. We will talk more of International Women's Day later on, which took place yesterday, yesterday being the 8th of March. But one of my favourite International Women's Day tweets, someone I follow called Louise, tweeted a picture of Norma Waterson and Eliza Carthy for International Women's Day. It doesn't get any better, does it, really?
You're so right. I think both are quite inspirational and, you know, absolute icons. And any young girls could do a lot worse than have them
because they play by their own rules, and I really like that.
A generation ago, when I was a teenager, I seem to be constantly looking back today, but there we are.
I was going to say, forwards, not back turn.
There were two things that kept us clinging to the radio back in those days, with that all-encompassing passion only known to the young. Mm. So one was Monday lunchtimes at school, where a secret radio was tuned to the FA Cup draw.
And excellent. The bloke with the bag in all of his glory.
Absolutely. It used to be there was no fiddling about with TV schedules and moving it around. It was every Monday lunchtime for the FA Cup when the games had been played. And it was always only on the radio. And
absolutely. Is it wrong for me at this point to be a slightly snotty, nosed, cheeky youngster and ask you if you listened to this only at school and it was still in the era when they commentated on football on the radio and they had a grid with numbered squares?
I think that was a little bit before this.
Okay. But I stand corrected.
Of course, people say that's where the expression back to square one comes
yes,
from.
Yes, of course. You see, I do think that I do provide a better class of trolling, I must admit.
Well, I think I should just quickly explain for anyone who doesn't know what we're talking about. I think in the Radio Times they printed a grid with the football pitch marked out into numbers so that when they were commentating on the radio, there would be one man saying, and Smitherson plays it along to Jones, and Jones flying along the wing there. And I believe in the background, another man was going, square one, square four, square six.
So I'm enjoying your 1930s. This is the joke, dear listeners, that I'm implying that Terence was at school in the 1930s, which is extremely mean of me. But I'm enjoying your 1930s radio announcer voice to the point where I think you might have been, because clearly you have great familiarity with this.
Clearly, I would have been at home in those days with Alvar Lidell in the 1930s on the BBC. This is the BBC Home Service. The other unmissable radio,
all the hits all the time.
All the hits all the time. The other unmissable radio event each week was the announcement of the new Top 40 on Radio 1. It all seemed terribly important. And as a teenager, you felt this kind of strange sense of victory if one of your favourite singles or groups was rocketing up the charts. It felt absolutely subversive as well that The Clash and X-Ray Specs were up there mingling with David Soul and Brotherhood of Man and whoever. But over the years, the way we do things changes, of course. Now the chart includes downloads and streaming. And I wonder if the UK Top 40 or the Billboard Hot 100 matters even at all. Now, last week, Stormzy dominated many of the places in the top 40.
This entire podcast is worth it just to hear Terence pronounce Stormzy, I think. That's the winner this week.
And in this week's midweek update, Ed Sheeran holds 9 of the top 10 positions. It's sad in a way that a little nugget of pleasure has gone, but nobody cares about the charts now, do they, Jules?
Well, probably not is the answer, isn't it? And that's the end of this segment. No, I'll try and widen this out a bit. Just like you, when I was a ute, I was very keen on the top 40, listening to the top 40. Well, actually, the thing that I mourn the loss of the most is not necessarily the top 40 in itself, but the chart show on ITV. There are certain people in my generation, you say the words chart show and you get this kind of Proustian type rush. It's amazing. I mean, so for me, Saturday mornings used to be getting up, watching a bit of kids' TV, even though I was too old, going into town, going to Woolworths, buying a single on tape from Woolworths, and then coming back and watching the chart show. And the good thing about the chart show was, if you didn't have Sky, it was the only way you got to watch music videos, so you didn't really see those very often on Top of the Pops. And also, it used, as well as doing the main chart, they used to do a different other chart each week. So they would have the indie chart one week. When it was still a thing, the indie chart. I think the day the indie chart died for me was the day that Britney Spears was number one because she was on Jive.
Oh, good God.
And that was the day that I realised there was no indie chart anymore. But, or they'd do the dance chart one week or you know, because they used to be, of course, in the days of the music press, and this is all connected, isn't it, really, in the days of the NME and the music weeklies that used to publish, and the Melody Maker that used to publish the charts in there, you'd also see the different charts in there as well. So being number five on the dance chart used to be a genuine achievement rather than having sold about 400 singles, and so in a way, yeah, the chart was a big thing. I've still got loads of C90 tapes at home that I, you know, used to tape music off the radio, and we could do a whole thing about the pleasure of taping music off the radio, making sure you don't get the talking in and all that kind of stuff. And yeah, like you, I remember being, you know, wanting certain records to get to number one. I can still remember, I was telling this story to someone the other day, we were remembering, I think it was Richard III by Supergrass versus Hush by Cooler Shaker, I think, which, yes, doesn't that describe the mess in which late 90s music found itself? And there was something like 500 copies in it, I think, in the end. It was when records really, really sold. And when any kind of records were really selling. Remember, for goodness sake, Cooler Shaker at number two. It really was a different time, wasn't it? As fond as I am of the...
I love the Cooler Shaker.
As fond as I am of the Bangra Bothering Hitmakers. So, but again, the last big chart moment that I remember was working in Marks and Spencer's over Christmas as a student, and it was the Christmas number one, and it was a Gary Jules, Mad World.
Oh, yes.
Versus Christmas Time, Don't Let the Bells End by The Darkness, which were both interesting records in their own way. I remember admiring The Darkness for just making a proper Christmas record that is, despite The Darkness being The Darkness, really quite good, I think, as far as those things go. And I can still remember four of us hiding in a cupboard in the warehouse. No, we were hiding in the lift. We hid in the lift of the warehouse and didn't go upstairs with a radio to find out what was number one. And that would have been 2004, I think, 2003. So it was some time ago. And I don't know whether we've got old, Terence, because I know that I am this show's designated young person.
You are.
But I'm still, you know, over 30, which is, in terms of youth culture sort of standards, old. And I don't know whether we stopped caring about it, or actually whether it's difficult to care. So the chart had to change because the way that people bought music changed. They then included downloads as well. But of course, I think I read a good article about this somewhere. I can't remember what it was now. The problem is that if you are that kind of chipped away at the idea that if you buy a single, if you've gone to the shop to buy a single, you haven't just invested in that financially. I think you've put effort into it, haven't you? You are committed. If you haven't, even if you haven't bought everything that that band's ever done, you are committed to buying that song by that band. To drop it down a level, if you then include downloads, yeah, you've had to make an effort to get on your iPad or whatever to download a tune. But, you know, that's one run down, isn't it? You can do that in your pyjamas. So that's less, as I frequently do. So that's less kind of committed, isn't it? And this article said that now they include streaming as well. Admittedly, you have to stream much more to include things in the chart. And actually, I don't know if I said this last week, I meant to if I didn't, so apologies for hearing this again, but the best-selling debut album on the British charts in 2016 was by Bradley Walsh.
Oh, gosh.
It was an album of light jazz covers, you know, standard. And the reason that it sold 100,000, I think, and was the biggest selling debut album. And I read an article saying something like, yeah, I can't bring myself to dislike Bradley Walsh, but it said something along the lines of that it was bought as a Christmas present for grandparents or by older people that are the only sort of type that still buy CDs. And because of the weird rules about streaming and buying an album on iTunes, I think it's something to do with the fact you can buy individual tracks. You have to stream an album hundreds of times for it to count as one, I think, or something. Right. So that's the reason behind that, which in a way does make a mockery of the album charts. And so now you're including streaming as well. It's casual, isn't it? You're kind of including, I mean, just because I want to listen to a song and look it up on YouTube doesn't necessarily mean that I want to buy it. It's just, you know, I just fancy hearing it. That's a different thing to going out and buying something, or even, you know, buying a tune in your pajamas. And which is why I think we've ended up with this situation where artists can sort of dominate the top 40, really, because you're massively narrowing down how people hear music, I think.
Yes, I'm sure that that's right. It's odd how emotions affect us when we're young. I was just thinking there, I can remember a serious sense of almost exhilaration if London Calling moved up two places on the single chart.
Yes.
And a genuine sadness, you know, if a favourite single dropped down. And
absolutely.
Another thing that's changed is that there was a time when I think I can truthfully say I knew every word of every lyric of every song in the top 40. And now I'm amazed if I've heard one song out of the 40.
Yeah, absolutely. The only reason I know what's number one is because there's been talk about the fact that it's all Ed Sheeran, basically.
Yes,
otherwise I would not know at all. I can still remember the joy. I remember thinking the tide was obviously turning when I was training to be a solicitor. This would have been late 2000s. And I think Fireflies by Owl City got to number one. And it was basically a guy that lived in his parents' back bedroom. But it's not as sad as that sounds, really. But there was a bit of a melancholia about it, because I think he'd been in the press saying he'd had some problems in his life. And it was really sweet. And I can still remember turning to our office junior and saying, because they used to have the radio on downstairs, and saying, I really like this number one. It's nice to hear a number one that I like. And she just grinned at me and went, it's starting. And she was so, so right. I was cross with her at the time for being 23 and smug. But but actually, it was starting. And your thing about the exhilaration of a tune that you like doing well. But of course, you had to get to a certain height in the charts to get onto Top of the Pops, didn't you? And firstly, I remember Biss playing Candy Pop as an unsigned band on Top of the Pops. Rick Blacksell was producing Top of the Pops in the late 90s and made it into a bit of an indie showcase. I remember thinking it was amazing that an unsigned band of Scottish teenagers that couldn't really play, to be honest, as much as I love Candy Pop, went on. I remember thinking that was great. But the biggest victory, I think, as a kind of a young indie nerd, I can remember being around my best friend's house and us storming into the front room, almost literally pushing her mum out of the way to turn the TV on, because Belle and Sebastian's Legal Man had made the top 20, I think, and they were on Top of the Pops performing. And there was a mini stage invasion, as there always is at Belle and Sebastian events. I have taken part in one, you know, they always happen. But I remember watching the Stuart Murdoch had a Dennis the Menace t-shirt on, and they were kind of, you know, they were singing, and you know, and there were a few fans got on the stage, and I remember me and my friend being really, really excited that Ben Bastion, this kind of bedroom indie band, had crashed Top of the Pops. We didn't see it as selling out, we just thought it was brilliant that something we really liked had turned up on Top of the Pops and was a really special thing. So actually, I don't want to say I'm sad that future generations won't experience this, because it just makes me sound like Skewed's Corner in Private Eye. But it is a pity. Like you, I am a bit sad, because I have such fond memories of the chart feeling really important, actually. And the Record Club Supper that I went to recently, talked about on the previous podcast, I made a topic. One of the topics I picked was just called The General Public Are Idiots. And my choice for that was Common People by Pulp, because it was held off with the number one spot by Robson and Jerome, and I am still extremely bitter about it. And there was a lovely story, and I think it was John Harris's The Last Party, which is a history of Britpop, when chart positions still mattered, that the two record labels, so Island and EMI, used to have offices that were opposite each other or near each other, and you could see the windows. And they used to put their chart positions up in pieces of paper stuck on the windows, sort of, you know, so each letter was on a piece of A4, and they used to wind each other up. And Island put up Pulp's position in the midweek, and EMI rung them up and went, oh, congratulations, number 21, that's really good. They didn't realize the one was an exclamation mark.
That's such a
you know, I miss those days when, you know, you had record companies winding each other up, and it was all, you know, and it was all really important. I mean, Oasis and Blur, that number one race was just appalling, wasn't it? I mean, appalling in the sense that, and actually Alex James said that in a way he felt that was responsible for the accidental killing off of the Indian alternative sector, actually. He said that he described it as that stupid pantomime, and it kind of gave the lie to the idea that it didn't really matter if you didn't sell many records because you were an Indian alternative band. So and in a way that had an impact on the chart as well, I think. So Yes, those changes, eh? It's like we're sitting on a bench, smoking pipes, and watching the world go by, isn't it?
You have some public appearances coming up this week. And
I certainly do, yeah.
I'm unsure if you'll be playing anything from the top 40.
Yeah, oh, gosh. This reminds me of being jostled by some patrons at a Christmas party, a Works Christmas do I've been booked to play for. Can we have something a bit more contemporary spat up from accounts? No, you cannot. I did do Groovies in the Heart. That the most modern records I play. I think I play some Hot Chip occasionally, but I'm not a chart person, and I always make a virtue of that. Anyway, yes, I do. I am doing an indie night. We're recording this on Thursday, the 9th of March. Friday, the 10th of March, for it is that day, I am doing Rip It Up, a highly contemporary named after an 80s alternative record. Indie night, indie alternative, etc. down at the Palace, which is a pub that used to be called the Pig in Paradise on Hastings Seafront, from 10 until 2 a.m. So please do come and bring a sugary drink with you. I'd really like that. Also, what else am I doing? Oh yeah, Saturday Social this week, Saturday evening. I will be doing music from a year. I'm 95% sure it's going to be 1965. So I think we'll call it that. So that's 6 till 7 on barricaderadio.com. And then I'm back with Indie Wonderland again next week, 8 till 10 p.m. on the radio. So barricaderadio.com, Indie Alternative, and Miscellaneous.
From the land of Tunnocks tea cakes, we thank you.
Deep fried Tunnocks tea cakes. That's what I'd like to experience.
Thanks to executive producer Rona. Now, I strongly suspect that this Huggy Bear we're about to hear from is it's less Starsky and Hutch and more Riot Girl.
It is, and congratulations on your excellent pronunciation of that. I'm grateful for it. Yes, as tempting as it was to pick an instrumental, I thought I'd need to kind of let that alley of trolling go. And speaking of trolling, I had some excellent trolling from my own father on International Women's Day, who did literally send me a When is International Men's Day email when I was at work. And he said, mind you, he said, I accidentally found out about this important event of International Women's Day. I trust you are enjoying the festivities. So, of course, I wished him the compliments of the season in return. All hail my trolling dad. I did tell him that there is an International Men's Day on the 19th of November, and he replied and said he'd put it in his diary to celebrate with his multicultural friends, brackets all two of them. So what can I say? We wish him well. International Women's Day, I very much enjoyed doing my all women indie show last night. Very much it's I like that even more than the Christmas Day show, really. Jess Phillips, the excellent Labour feminist MP, said, well, I have very much enjoyed Feminist Christmas today, and that's what it kind of feels like, really. I wrote a piece about this tune we're going to play now for the Rocking Vicar, which is now rolling on again, we see, about basically how much I love this record and how it is, I think, just a real force. And in a way, it's in my top five records of all time, and I wish it wasn't, because it feels more relevant than ever, and I want the records about these kind of struggles to be less relevant rather than more relevant, really. But anyway, I think this is great. Also, Moments of Music TV, we were talking about earlier. Huggy Bear playing this on The Word. I accidentally saw this as an 8-year-old, and I think it changed everything, frankly. They were later thrown out of the studio for getting involved in a row, I think, over some pole dancers or something. But anyway, this is Huggy Bear, and this is Her Jazz.
Yeah.
You have been listening to a DACA Media production.